Hello again, and welcome to the next week in your practice session with Bill O'Hanlon and Drs. Rick Hansen and Ruth Baczynski. Dr. Hansen is a neuropsychologist, speaker, and New York Times bestselling author. He's also the founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. Bill O'Hanlon is a licensed marriage and family therapist, inspirational speaker, and author of more than 35 books. In this part of the course, our aim is to give you concrete strategies you can use in your life and work with patients.
Bill, what struck you most about the webinar with Stephen Porges?
Well, I'm going to start kind of in a sideways way because I saw this show on PBS about dogs, the evolution of dogs. And they said, dogs, and those of us who have dogs or cats, we know this difference. Dogs are so finely attuned to human voice tones and human facial expressions. They know, you know, what your mood is. When you're angry at them, they'll know instantly. Cat is like, ah, who cares? You're angry at me, big deal. You know, the cats aren't so attuned and they're not so responsive. And dogs co-evolve with us. And I think we humans evolved in social groups being very sensitive to facial expressions and voice tone. It's part of our survival. It's part of how we knew how to get along with other people, how to make sure we weren't left out of the tribe, if you will. So I think that it's so important what Stephen Porges said about this, that the body and the interpersonal aspects often get short shrift in psychotherapy, which typically puts an emphasis on the individual and on the psyche. And I think bringing that stuff back in is such a service to us, realizing that the body, the voice, the facial expression is so intertwined with both the how we get messed up with trauma and also how we heal from trauma. So that really just stood out for me in fine, you know, relief. I really, it was good to be reminded of that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Rick, how about you?
Sure. Well, first I want to speak up for cats because we have one, or I should say he has us. But anyway.
Me too.
There you are.
A cat too.
Yeah. Well, two things kind of briefly. One is I was struck by his comment that as these three, if you will, branches of the vagus nerve evolved, the last one, the myelinated mammalian social engagement system, does exercise top-down control over the flight sympathetic response system and the quieting, even shutting down parasympathetic system. So to me, that's very hopeful, actually, that something like therapy, the so-called relationship cure, can actually be a cure because we very much do engage this social system, which has been handed to us, in effect, through evolution, so to help regulate these more ancient drives and impulses. And I think part of what happens sometimes in therapy with people who've been disturbed in their relationship field, you know, their object relations, to use that language, has been messed up, their relationship paradigms. Part of our job is to reclaim the capacity of the social system to do its therapeutic work, and then once it's reclaimed, use it, you know, to do that therapeutic work.
Okay. Bill, a lot of what Stephen talked about was prosody, tone of voice, and it's a big part of the vagal system. How can we use that knowledge to improve our treatments?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I learned hypnosis years ago from Milton Erickson, and he had a very gentle way and rhythmic way of speaking. And I've heard other people do hypnosis. You will go into trance, go deeply, roll your eyes back in your head, count 1, 2, 3. That doesn't seem relaxing to me. It doesn't seem to invite that kind of thing. And I remember years ago hearing this story from Hans Eysenck, a British psychologist, who heard this story about a surgeon on the, a surgeon in training on the battlefield in World War I in France. And he was there, and some French soldier got blown apart and was writhing around, was going to die if he didn't calm down till they could get him back to the surgical tent. So this soldier out there knew very little French, and he tried to tell the person to calm down, but it wasn't working. Finally, he flashed back to a hypnosis demonstration he'd seen in medical school, and all he did was say, in a very rhythmic voice, to this French soldier, the only French he knew that would maybe do this, your eyes are closing, your eyes are closing, your eyes are closing. He repeated it in that really rhythmic way, and the person went into a kind of a trance, got him back, saved his life, and he's telling the other British surgeons when he comes back, hey, I did hypnosis, and he tells them what he said, and they all burst out laughing because his French was so bad. What he was really saying was, your ears are closing, your ears are closing, your ears are closing. But because he said it in that rhythmic way, it calmed this person down. So I think that rhythm and the voice tone is so powerful to calm people down. When they've been traumatized, it's almost like you have to approach them like a very skittish doe in the woods. They're so frightened that that soft voice and the rhythm may help people calm down so they can be available for the trauma treatments that we're going to offer, or so that they can be available if we're not doing treatment, if we're just in an interpersonal relationship, calm down enough to take in the good, as Rick would say.
You know, Bill, we were talking earlier about our cats. All three of us have cats. And my cat responds very much to tone of voice. It wouldn't really matter what I said, but when I say, oh, you're such a good girl, I could be saying, you're such a jerk. And you know what I mean? She just responds to
the voice tone.
And the same way if I'm angry and so forth.
Well, I think that's a really good point in terms of what do you do with this next week. Think about your traumatized, the people that you know that are traumatized, you're in relationship with, or you're doing therapy with, or doing work with, as the animal self, and approach them with that rather than the rational, you know, words explaining things. It's much more approachable on that animal level, like you would with your cat or your dog or a horse, approaching them like the trauma whisperer, maybe, you know.
Yeah. So, Rick, staying with that and maybe expanding on it some, one of the key windows into the vagus is affect, and that would include tone of voice, but also how our faces look. What other body signals would it include or would you look for during trauma treatment?
Right. I think that's where, for example, Paul Ekman, of course, has been so helpful. And I could put a plug in for the first season of Lie to Me. It's this great British actor, his name escapes me, plays essentially Paul Ekman. Yeah, good.
Wait, Bill, say it again.
Tim Roth.
Right.
He plays the Paul Ekman kind of character, yeah.
Yeah. So the point is, I myself really look a lot at the little tiny muscles around the eyes and around the mouth. Both of those are tells, if you will. And you're tracking expressions that happen usually in about a quarter to half of a second often, sometimes a little bit longer. So be prepared for very quick things. But that is powerful. Another one is breathing. I think breathing is something to really be aware of in our clients. And also be aware of our own breathing, which sometimes comes into resonance with that of our clients, which gives us an internal signal. The other thing I've started doing is a funny little weird mental weirdness, I don't know, where I look at someone I'm being with, and I just tell myself in my head, what's happening to you is happening to me. Now, don't do this if you're psychotic, don't do this if you're hallucinating or on LSD, but otherwise, if you have reasonably good boundaries, don't use this with major borderline clients, but reasonable boundaries, it actually draws me really into the other person and really stimulates the natural ancient empathic circuitry we have, and it naturally also tends to draw me into a caring response for them. So anyway, those are things I do.
Thanks, Rick.
I find them really helpful.
Rick, isn't there a meditation, a Buddhist practice where you take on the experience of another person? What's that called? Tonglen?
Yeah, Tonglen. But here's actually a very important detail about that. That practice, as it's traditionally taught, and there are variations on it, but the essence of it is first you connect with, in their language they'll talk about it as a deity figure, but we could talk about it perhaps as an archetypal image or a kind of a, I think of it as your own internal compassion committee, people who are on your side, maybe real people in your life today or in your past who are very nurturing. You start with really connecting with, initially outside yourself, forces, let's say, that are extremely loving and nurturing, and then you internalize them. as if they're inside you in a very healthy way. And at that point, then, you allow to come into you the suffering of the other person to be purified in this process. But it's very important to do those other things first.
Bill, Stephen coined the term neuroception to describe how the nervous system evaluates risk. How can we make sure a client's nervous system's neuroceives safety, perceives safety in sessions?
You're coining terms now, too. That's great. I think that what we talked about before was that voice tone is so important. And the paying attention, as you know, Rick just talked about, to the micro expressions, which are giving you hints of where they are. But I think mostly that attunement, matching them, matching their breathing, matching their facial expressions, matching their movements. I remember years ago, two kind of studies that were informal, but I thought told us something about this. One is they took a video camera and they videoed kids at play in the playground. And the kids that were high on that autistic spectrum were off rhythm with the other kids. The other kids, if you sped it up, it was like they were in a dance with one another. It was very rhythmic with one another. Even though they were moving differently, they were in rhythm. And Violet Oaklander, who you know is a psychotherapist, Gestalt therapist, as some of us remember, from some years ago, we studied Gestalt, she had a challenge connecting with these autistic kids who weren't communicating, were not going to be in therapy. And she would get down when they were rocking, and she would rock in rhythm with them. And then she would slightly change her movements or rhythm, and they would change with her. And I think it's that kind of attunement, that physical attunement that we're talking about with the polyvagal stuff here, really getting into the body attunement, that bottom level connection, and then you can move up to a higher level connection, I think.
Rick, Stephen talked a lot about dissociative states, how they're influenced by physiology. How should we work with dissociative states? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. He's linking those to the freeze response, in which the most primitive, most ancient branch of the vagal system, the parasympathetic branch, radically shuts an animal down, so it plays dead. But as he points out, sometimes playing dead becomes real dead, mm-hmm. literally, mm-hmm. in various species of fish. They will just sink literally to the bottom of the lake, and then, in effect, there's no oxygen down there, so they die. So I think it's quite helpful to appreciate that in a dissociative response, often the body is really quieting down to a fault. It's getting too quiet. So one ways out of it are to do things at higher levels, if you will, in the vagal hierarchy, where, for example, we're bringing in more sympathetic nervous system arousal, more engagement through things like inhaling. Inhaling uses the sympathetic nervous system. That's the second branch of the vagus nerve. Another one is to slowly and appropriately stand up, because as we stand up, the sympathetic nervous system activates to maintain blood pressure so that we can not faint, in effect, when we stand up. Also, standing up does other things as well in terms of being activated. Another thing is to look for intensity. I think that when someone is in a dissociative state, they're, in effect, off the battlefield. They want to be ignored, right? And okay, maybe that was adaptive in a certain situation, but these days it's not that adaptive. So helping a person feel more energized, more activated, bigger, drawing attention to themselves, letting themselves be seen, things like that I find are really quite helpful. And then the last thing I'll just say about dissociation is to have a lot of compassion for it, because it's a huge hijack. I had a client who would routinely dissociate right in the middle of therapy sessions, and it was almost a kind of narcolepsy, where she would just slump in the seat, slide out of the seat. Mm. She just had to go away. And what made her go away, interestingly, were experiences of caring contact with me, because that was so threatening, because it was associated with pain when she was a child, or the longing for it was associated with pain. I actually had a time where I went out to the parking lot an hour after our session, saw her car there, and she was huddled up in the back seat with the engine running. She wasn't trying to kill herself or anything, She had just turned her car on and then laid down in the back seat and just went out, completely out. So these are very powerful states, and oftentimes people are ashamed of them, they hide them, and, you know, kind of reclaiming dissociation as a normal adaptive response, but now it's a good thing gone too far. For me, you know, it can help us with these people.
So how did you work with her when she would dissociate right in the session?
I, like Bill would, as he spoke of a few moments ago, I would get very soothing and literally at an animal level. I remember the title of one of these books I read in grad school, you all probably know it, Psychotherapy: The Art of Wooing Nature. I really feel like I'm trying to woo this terrified animal that's hovering on the edge of this clearing where I'm sitting by my campfire. It's kind of how I think of myself sometimes. And I'm trying to help this person come out of the woods and feel safe enough. So I don't want to startle them. I want to move very slowly, make it easy and normal. Going on being, I think, is so important for these people because it literally feels like a mortal threat. We don't engage that system unless it's our last all else fails method of freeze, you know, because otherwise you get eaten.
That reminds me of the feral cat that I feed. In addition to my own cat and at home, there's a feral cat outside, and she's way too scared to... I've never touched this cat, but the cat shows up to be fed, and I think to sit on the porch and just be there. And I try to talk to the cat in a quiet, soothing voice, and I open the door and stand there. I don't come out right away so that she can get ready.
Yeah, or make jarring gestures. I've been there for that. For the cat, if you move really quickly or jarringly, she's gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to build on that word to close out here, Ruth, you used feral. That is such a good word. And I think in our clients, and I can say this personally, in myself, there is a feral core. It's not immoral. It's not malevolent. But it's like a hawk nailing the bunny. It's not personal, but that hawk will do whatever it needs to do to survive. And people are often kind of ashamed of that core.
Yeah.
And yet it's a very central aspect of coping and being adaptive, especially if you're being attacked or traumatized.
And if you stay with the whole analogy a little bit, the cat that's my family cat, discovered us as a kitten. And she adopted us and came in the house with no fear. It's like, well, of course you're going to like me, and so forth. Whereas the feral cat was an adult and survives quite well, but is totally terrified. And you can see the difference in upbringing. Okay. Everyone, we have to stop now and stop our cat conversations. Yeah. We should get pictures of our cats.
We started with dogs and went to cats.
Yeah. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching this session. We hope you'll go ahead and take these ideas and begin using them in your work. In part 4, you'll find your quick start guide. It's an at-a-glance reference to the most critical concepts and practices from this short course. You'll be able to use this to refresh your memory so you'll feel confident in turning these insights into action. And in part 5, you'll find the transcripts. You'll be able to download, print, and refer to these professionally formatted transcripts as often as you like. Thanks again for watching.